Since last August, Stanford, MIT, Princeton, the University of Michigan, the University of Pennsylvania, and the University of California at Berkeley have all announced that they will soon offer massive open online courses, or MOOCs, in an effort to make their top-flight curriculums available to the world for free. Several of these universities have been putting their lectures and syllabuses on the open web for years. But while broadcasting a course is one thing, engaging hundreds of thousands of students in meaningful, measurable learning experiences is another. It requires technology that can replicate the personal attention of a private tutor hundreds of thousands of times over. In order to make sure individual students are learning in these massive courses, universities and their partners will have to design software that is capable of learning about students, what they don't know, what they do know, and what they need to close that gap. It's called machine learning, and it's not new. Candace Till, director of Carnegie Mellon University's Open Learning Initiative, has been teaching machines how to learn about students for years. I talked with Till this week about the new MOOCs at Stanford and MIT and elsewhere, about her own work building free online courses using intelligent software platforms, and the future of machine learning in higher education. This idea of massive open online courses, not only as a teaching tool, but as a research project with the recent announcement by MIT and Harvard, and also software that's being developed by Khan Academy and a couple of private companies that grew out of Stanford's experiments last fall, are kind of on the tip of everyone's tongue. You've been doing this for a couple years. What have you found out about machine learning that informs your opinion about what the possibilities might be for these new projects and what the limitations might be?
Okay. So the massively open online courses take advantage of certain aspects of the technology that most people think of when they think of online technology, and that is mass distribution. So one of the real powers of the technology is you can give access to people, to information that was previously really hard to give access to. Convenience. Students can use these materials anytime, any place. The mistake that they're making, I think, is that two things. One of them is that where students learn is not necessarily in just passively listening to lectures or reading text. Mm-hmm. Where students learn is in attempting to perform. And then while they're performing, sort of conditional on the quality of the feedback that they're getting while they're attempting to perform, and the opportunities to refine their performance based on that feedback. And a lot of the massively online courses at this point in time are still focusing on the part of higher education, which is just exposition, pushing forward.
And then also high-stakes assessments.
And usually when they're speaking about high-stakes assessments, what they're usually talking about are sort of multiple-choice kinds of questions, the kinds of things that computers historically have been really easily score. And just like the early sort of computer-aided instructional things, what you can give students is feedback on their answer. But what we really want to understand is what's the process, what's the thought process that the student goes through when they're working on a complex task to arrive at that answer. Mm-hmm. And so just giving the student feedback on yes, no, right, wrong, or some feedback on their answer isn't going to allow us to really support the student to give them feedback on their thought processes or on their activity in a way that'll be actionable for them to be able to refine their performance in the future.
Now I know that something that MIT has talked about is creating virtual lab environments where students can sort of play around in a sandbox or try to complete projects or even really just mess around with circuits in a way that's less of a directed exercise environment as something that drills them with problems that they need to solve. Do you think that there's a lot of opportunity in that kind of environment to collect data that can teach us more about learning?
Absolutely. There's and those are the kinds of environments we have in the OLI courses as well, mm-hmm. is we have both these sort of small tutored learning activities and then these really rich, more authentic project task environments. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if what they're doing, I haven't seen the edX environment, but one of the things that we found to be really critical in these environments is when you're designing activities or tasks for students to do in these environments, to be able to collect the data about their moves in the environments that can give us some insight into how they're trying to progress towards completing that task. And then looking at what moves are meaningful so that you can intervene at various points to give students feedback that actually supports them to effectively achieve those tasks.
Which is what Khan Academy says it's trying to do in its exercise environment.
So mathematics education is there's been years of research trying to understand how students learn mathematics, and any design of a concept map or mastery system should start with what the research tells us we know so far, and then collect the data at a fine enough grain level to refine that understanding. That's really the power of this technology, is to start with a design that's the best of what we think we know about how people learn, both in general, but also in a particular subject area, and then instrument the learning environment to a fine enough grain size that you can refine that theoretical model.
Mm-hmm. Is the Khan model a little scattershot, you're saying, by the standards of...
The underlying assumptions of mastery that drive that model are not necessarily those that would have been designed by the learning research.
Okay. So what do we know about learning at this point? I know the answer is surprisingly little, based on some of the certitude with which people talk about it. That's the
challenge. It's sort of like going, we've all been to the doctor, but we wouldn't say we understand how medicine works, you know? But most of us say, oh, I was a student. I know how I learned something. So that must be how learning works. And which is, you know, fine when that's all you have to go on. But now we can ask pretty sophisticated questions about learning and use this massive amount of data we can collect to answer those questions in a much more robust way. And most of the arguments, and they end up being arguments about educational approach, end up being presented as sort of dichotomies. Is it better to give students drill on basic skills? Or is it better to give them more complex tasks so they develop more conceptual understanding? The real answer to that is, it depends. You know, is it better to explain things to students or to give students a question and make them construct the explanation for themselves? The answer to that is, it depends. Is it better to give students graphical representations to help them understand a phenomenon or a text base? Is it better to put students into sort of collaborative learning experiences or individual learning? And I can give you studies that show you answers to both those questions.
Sure. So you're dealing with this problem within OLI, mm-hmm. because you're designing courses in statistics and other disciplines that are designed to satisfy the particular needs of certain types of students in a way that any institution can theoretically pick up and use in a certain way. So how are you dealing with that problem of variability when you're designing the OLI courses?
So we design the OLI courses. First off, I should say that every course we design, we say, is a hypothesis. It's not a complete course that just go ahead and use it, it'll guarantee teach you X. It's a hypothesis based on our best understanding of the current, what we know about learning, current affordances of the technology, and the faculty domain experts that participated in the design. So we put it out there, we have students use it, and then we collect the data to see what's working and what's not working, and target redesign based on the changes in the technology, changes on the domain, and the data that we're collecting. While there is a sort of fixed path through OLI, it is web-based. And so we have lots of opportunities where students and teachers can work through a certain learning experience and then check whether did they get it. So here's the outcome you're trying to achieve. Did you get it? And then based on your own assessment about whether you got it or not, you can make a choice about, do you want to do some more supportive practice? Do you want to get a different explanation? Do you want to move on? So the way that we're trying to deal with the variability right now is just expose to the learner and to the instructor the best we can about what we believe the student's knowledge state is based on their interaction with the course so that they can make choices about what to do next.
So there is a role for the instructor to take the course and shape it in a particular way that they believe, based on their knowledge and observation of their students, would be most helpful in the context of who they're teaching, and whether it's a community college class or an introductory class or a more advanced class. There is sort of the notion that the instructor should exercise their judgment based on their own knowledge and intuition and not just let the computer make all the decisions.
Oh, absolutely. The OLI course, and we call them courses, but where they are most effective is taught in a hybrid mode, mm-hmm. where you have students and an instructor. So the instructor can, in the OLI interface, sort of select and sequence the modules. But the real power for the instructor comes in as the students are working through the environment and they're getting all the support and feedback. The other thing that the environment is doing is collecting that data to show the instructor where their student, where their class is along those learning outcomes that the modules are designed to support students to achieve. So we call that the instructor learning dashboard. So the way that would work is the instructor would say to the students, work through module 3 of the OLI course and do that before, if we're meeting Monday morning at 10 a.m., do that before Sunday night. And so the students are working through it, they're getting all the support, all the feedback, making their choices about, did I get this, what do I do next? But the system's collecting all of that data so that we can show the instructor on those 5 outcomes, what's your class looking like? Mm-hmm. And the instructor can look at just a quick view of, okay, on these outcomes, looks like most of the class is getting this or whatever. Or they can drill down and get a much more detailed view by student or by the different knowledge components that feed that outcome, the different activities that the students are engaged in, the way students have responded to open text responses. So they can get much better insight before they go into class about where their students are. And they use their skill and their art and their knowledge to say, okay, given that that's where my students are, how can I best use my class time?
And here's where, and this is your mantra about using technology to increase productivity, to create choices about how you want to use the extra time created by the increased productivity of the instructors and the students.
Increasing the productivity of the students, they're spending their out-of-class time engaged and attempting things and getting feedback so that their out-of-class time is spent much more productively, but also so the faculty members' time, which we actually think of as the most precious time, so they can use that time that they have with their students much more effectively. So either to target things that students are struggling with or to expand and extend beyond what they could have taught before.
So when you describe it like that, it sounds like a pretty plum deal for faculty. Now, I know that there's a lot of skepticism, nevertheless, among faculty about what this could mean if their institution took a particularly ambitious view of the efficiencies that this might create, or a dim view of what the faculty could add on top of this technology, and chose to just replace them, which is the perennial boogeyman, and which is not to say that it's not a realistic threat. OLI has had some uptake, and you are always making the rounds and talking to educators and policymakers all over the country. Why isn't everybody using these if they work so well?
So that's actually a big question that I'm exploring. So I think that some of the, I think one of the things that you named is definitely a barrier to uptake. There is a fear, and it's not, it's not unfounded given these pressures to reduce cost. One of the things that faculty often say to me is, you're trying to replace me with a computer. And that is not at all what we're trying to do. What we're trying to do is, we recognize that the context in which traditional higher education finds itself in right now, that the but we're trying to both contain or reduce cost and increase attainment, and do that with a student population that has a much greater variability in their background knowledge, their preparation, their current skills, even their future goals. And do all of that, increase quality, increase attainment, reduce cost, serve a much bigger and more diverse student body, and do it in an environment of shrinking resources. So the tools and techniques that we used to do higher education in the old context fit the old context. Those tools and techniques don't fit the current context. And what we need to do is develop better tools and techniques that support us to deliver the same kind of high quality learning experience to this much greater diversity of students and much greater number of students than we can using the old system. And while I can completely understand the fear in what these technologies can do, there's also a huge opportunity. And I think that what is true is that the emerging technologies, as well as the drive to competencies or outcomes in higher education, are changing higher education. And I think that's not stopping. It is changing. And my entreaty to faculty is, get out in front of this thing. And what we're trying to do in OLI is bring together the faculty voice in both defining what those competencies and outcomes should be. That when you say a student has successfully completed an introductory statistics course, what does that really look like? What does that really mean? And my concern is if we don't have faculty involved in defining what those outcomes are, they will get defined in very constrained, measurable ways. And we can now use the technology to define much more robust outcomes and then figure out together what kinds of tasks, what kinds of activities can we have students engage in that'll really both support them to achieve that higher level outcome, but also help us see whether or not they're achieving it.
Do you think institutions will be interested in going on that journey of exploration with their faculty, or do you worry that they might be interested in merely increasing efficiency and using the parts of the technology that they can use to get costs down?
Yeah, that's why I think that this, in some ways, what's needed is for faculty and administration in institutions, and I would even extend that probably to policymakers and legislatures. Everyone's trying to sort of define and solve the problem from their own perspective, and I think that's kind of a non-starter. I think the solution is to have administrators, legislators, and faculty sort of coming together, agreeing on really what is the value proposition, to put it in those terms. What is it that higher education is attempting to achieve, and how do we do that in an affordable way? And one of my fears about where higher education is going is a real bifurcated system, that you're going to have a few institutions that will be able to still essentially do higher education the way it's always been done for a small privileged group of students. And then the rest of higher education is going to become this sort of mass production experience. Fear is that institutions are trying to figure out how they claw their way into being in that small group that gets to still do the stuff the way we've always done it. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the wrong headset. I think we need to think about, how do we create really rich, appropriate learning experiences that are both satisfying to faculty, to students, to everybody, in a way that many, 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 many more students can take advantage of that.
Candace Till, thank you very much for joining me today.
You're welcome.